Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
Welcome back. It is 9:35. Views and News with me, Clarence, till 12. And of course, your questions for the Naked Scientist next. And that WhatsApp line, 0725671567. Your questions, send them through right now. You can call on 021-446-0567. We welcome Dr. Chris Smith, lecturer at the University of Cambridge. It's good to have you back, Chris.
Hey, morning. How are you?
I can't complain. It's really busy in your neck of the woods, isn't it? Politically, I mean.
Yeah. There's huge apathy, actually. I think I did go to the polling station and I asked the ladies there who were handing out the ballot papers, has it been a busy day? What's the turnout look like? Because I had a look down the sheet as they were crossing names off. I went just before closing time at 10 o'clock just to see how busy it was, really. And they told me that the turnout had been quite good. But then looking at their sheet, I'd say half the names were not crossed off, which means half the people in my neck of the woods didn't turn up to vote. So it looks like it's again a lowish turnout. So we end up with our sort of political system being determined by relatively few people who actually will turn out and exercise their democratic right to vote. And you think in some parts of the world you don't get a democratic right to vote. Don't waste the opportunity.
Yeah, well, we're watching the results with interest on this side. My first question in is from a gentleman who wants to know if women suffer flatulence.
Everyone suffers flatulence. What is it? Well, it's down to the bacteria that live in our guts. And both men and women have about 37 trillion bacteria living in our guts. There are more bacterial cells in your guts than there are human cells in the rest of your body. And there's an old saying, which is you never dine alone. Basically, your microbiome sees your dinner before you do. And things that we eat, anything that goes down our throats is seen by the microbes in our guts, and they have metabolic knives and forks, which we don't. And so there are some things that we can't break down that they do. And just as we burp and fart, they do the same. They belch out CO2, hydrogen. If you eat foodstuffs that have got sulfur in them, you can produce hydrogen sulfide. This is the smelly stuff that smells like rotten eggs. Also, you can produce methane, so you can fart and set light to it. That's absolutely possible as well. Don't do it. Bit dangerous. You can get burns and set fire to your pajamas. But it is theoretically possible. But because men and women's guts are both riddled with bacteria, we both have fartogenic potential. And men and women fart about the same amounts a day. I think the estimate is it's a couple of litres of fart gas per day that comes out of the average person.
Well, I think the question should have been, how can I be more discreet about my flatulence rather than do women suffer flatulence?
Well, it depends what you eat, doesn't it, Clarence? Because if you have a diet which is very rich in things that certain sectors of your microbiome are very good at metabolizing, then you will produce more gas. And the old saying, you know, beans are good for your heart. The more you eat them, the more you. Beans tend to contain a lot of complex carbohydrates, including sugars like raffinose. This cannot be readily digested by our digestive enzymes. And so these more complicated sugars end up in the big bowel where the bacteria see them. They can break them down, but in the process of doing that, they produce more gas. So some foodstuffs are more fartogenic than others. And if you are producing a lot of gas, it can be because of a switch in diet. As people often say, when you embrace a new regime of eating, often a good friend of mine, Giles Yeo, who appears on the BBC's Horizon programmes and things, he's a geneticist, very interested in diet and weight gain, weight loss, that kind of thing. He did a challenge to see if he could go vegan for a while. And he said couple of things, but one of them was very farty for the first fortnight or two. It probably is your microbiome gets used to your new eating habits.
Okay, I'm not certain if you should provide advice on the next question, but I'll read it anyway. In movies, people are hit against the head with a piece of wood or gun and then they fall unconscious. Is it possible, or must you be hit on a certain place on the head for it to happen? Keith wants to know, and I don't know why.
Hi, Keith. Well, the answer is that Hollywood does use some artistic license, but a bang to the head will render people unconscious. It does cause a concussion. And this is why in professional sport or even in amateur sport, if someone gets a knock on the head, then they're taken off the pitch and they're assessed and there can be consequences. But certainly in the immediate time that it happens, you can be stunned, and the shock to the brain can cause seizures and unconsciousness for a period of time. And the reason for that is that although your brain is protected inside your skull, it's bobbing around in fluid called cerebrospinal fluid. And the skull stopping suddenly, which is when you slam someone on the head, their skull stops suddenly, but they've got momentum. Or the skull moves suddenly, but the brain doesn't. You've got inertia. One hits the other, and the brain can collide with the inside surface of the skull, and it can be bruised, and this can cause a flurry of electrical discharges that cause a change in consciousness. The other thing that can happen is if you do get a bang on the head, you get what's called a contra coup injury as well, which is that the skull bashes into the brain, accelerates the brain, which then bashes into the skull on the opposite side as well. So you can actually get a 1-2 punch quite literally inside your head as well as outside.
I think a very important question. We're seeing a bit of an upsurge in violence and younger people, gang violence. Younger people are being implicated. And this morning with Lester Kivett, people were talking about young people with psychopathic tendencies. And the question is, please ask Dr. Christie, people are born with psychopathic tendencies, or are they socialized, nurtured or natured?
Probably both. In the same way that we've got animal studies that show that certain breeds of dog, we're looking at XL bullies, for example, in the UK legally at the moment, because they've been linked to a number of instances where these animals have turned on members of the public and even their own owners. There are breeding studies famously among foxes in countries in the former Soviet Union, where they've actually bred for traits, where if you select an animal that behaves a certain way and breed from it, you can breed and over time concentrate those traits in the progeny of that animal. This argues that there is an element of nature, in other words, genetics, wired into how we behave. But certainly it's more complicated and subtle than that, because nature as well as nurture are critical. And if you have an upbringing where you have to fight for everything you've got, then it tends to bring out those sorts of instincts if they're there. On the other hand, if you are shown the value of community spirit, considering others, etc., etc., you're less likely to see those things manifesting themselves. So I think there's no one discrete simple answer to this, but there are certainly elements of genetics in terms of how we tend to behave, but these are disclosed by how we're reared, where we're reared, and the sorts of opportunities and I suppose life chances that are afforded to us.
Okay, then please ask a Dr. Chris. So, although the sun is on its way back to us, and obviously this is a southern hemisphere perspective, the sun is on its way back to us after the solstice. The temperature is getting colder, and the opposite happens in February too, when the sun is on its way back north, but we get our hottest temperatures. Rob in Pinelands with that question.
You've got to remember that while the sun is the source of heat for the earth, and it doesn't just light things up, the arrival of light energy is absorbed into the ground, but also into the oceans, and slowly warms those things up. There is therefore a thermal inertia effect. In the same way that if I'm riding my bike down the road and I stop pedaling, I don't immediately stop. The bike has inertia. The heating effect accumulates in the oceans and in the ground. So even though the days become longer, then it takes a while before ground temperature increases enough to start influencing air temperature, and water temperature influences air temperature, and that brings the temperature up. So even though days may at the end of the summer begin to shorten, the summer is closing, the winter is coming, and days are getting shorter, there's enough embodied thermal energy in the ground and in the ocean that it props up the air temperature for much longer than you normally expect to. And this is why in the northern hemisphere there are people who go swimming in the seaside at Christmas time. On Christmas Day, it's kind of a tradition for some people. And this is because the sea is much warmer then than it ought to be based on the length of day, but there's still a lot of heat in the ocean. And as the year wears on, slowly that warmth ebbs away, and then has to start warming up again once the days become long and the air temperature is higher and the heat loss rates from the water and the land drop again. Heat loss rates drop again, so that there's more embodied energy back in there. So it's all about thermal inertia and the fact that you turn the light on and turn the heating on, but the room isn't instantly hot. That's what I'm getting at.
Makes perfect sense. And thank you for that. Let's go to that voice note in about plastic packaging.
Dr. Smith, I have a question about plastic packaging. We use a variety of different plastics, polypropylene, polyethylene, and so on, for packaging. And apparently only some of these are recyclable. That's in South Africa. I don't know about the rest of the world. Is there a particular reason why the different plastics are used? Is it convenience, or does it just happen to be the manufacturer's preference? Thank you. This is Mark. Bye.
Hi, Mark. The answer is all of the above, really. Different chemical compositions of what we call plastic give different properties to that material. So if you want a material that is very thin and very light and very flexible and very nice against the skin for various products and that kind of thing, clothing even, you would choose a different chemical composition. You put different numbers of carbon atoms and different arrangements of your carbon atom chains in your polymers and other things as well to give that characteristic. And this means that it's horses for courses. Some plastics have very different characteristics to others. And if we mix them up, you then end up with all those characteristics blended. And it's a bit like taking the different paint, which individual colours look great on the wall. But if I mixed all the tins of paint together, I'd end up with a horrible grey that would not look so attractive on the wall. So if you want the right sort of characteristic for your plastic, you have to have the right chemical composition. But that's quite hard to determine and discriminate when you've just got a pile of plastic in front of you. So what they're tending to do is to say, well, we'll recycle into meaningful things some of these plastics, some of these thermoplastics, things that you can warm up, they change shape and distort, you can mold them into new stuff, we can use those ones. Others, they're not so easy to work with, so they end up in landfill anyway. So this is the reason. It's down to the fact that different plastics are made of different chemicals and they don't all talk nicely to each other in a test tube. So you can't just put them all together, heat them up, melt them down and turn them into new plastic, a bit like you could with aluminium, because aluminium drinking cans or steel cans for food, for example, they're all the same material by and large. So it's not the end of the world if you melt them all down. There's a few paint chips and that kind of thing, but you get aluminium back or steel back. You can't say the same with plastic. It's a real heterogeneous mix of stuff.
Thank you for this opportunity, says Brioni. Please, can you tell me if a heart problem where the left ventricle muscle has enlarged has developed, can the muscle be reduced in size?
It depends. Now, if you're a professional sportsman or woman, and we've been watching the Euros, for example, playing out, a lot of those footballers are going to have a heart rate of about 40 a minute. Mine's about 70. The reason their heart rate is low is because they are trained and fit, and this means they have made their heart get bigger. And a bigger, beefier heart muscle pumps more blood with every beat, and therefore it doesn't have to beat so often in order to expel the same volume of blood, so their resting heart rate's lower. That's called physiological cardiac enlargement or hypertrophy. If I went to the gym and lifted weights, or in my case recently, I built a patio, I've got a lot stronger because using skeletal muscle increases the amount of muscle mass in order to respond to the demand you're putting on it. But now I've finished making my patio, and if the sportsman stopped running around the field or stopped going to the gym, then the muscle would slowly atrophy or reduce in size again. But in the case of a heart enlargement that is pathological, this is called pathological cardiac hypertrophy. This can happen for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's genetic, and there are a family of diseases called hypertrophic cardiomyopathies. Sometimes it's structural, and this is because if, say, a person has high blood pressure and the heart enlarges to produce more force in order to push the blood against a higher pressure. If you don't treat the high blood pressure, or you don't treat the valve, which means that the blood is facing a big obstruction to moving out of the heart, it's going to stay big. On the other hand, if you do take away those reversible causes, there's every reason, if caught early, the heart could reduce in size. But one frustration is that when cardiac muscle does pathologically enlarge like this, it doesn't just add muscle, it can also add some fibrous tissue which stiffens the heart, and this doesn't disappear be removed when you take away some of the other provoking factors. So it will really come down to what has caused the ventricle to enlarge. Not all ventricular enlargements are pathological, and in some cases taking away the cause will reverse some of the problem, but not always. So it really matters what the diagnosis is, and that means you've got to go and talk to a heart specialist who can advise on that.
Nuclear rods power submarines, power aircraft carriers. Why can they not power spaceships? They last for decades.
Well, the nuclear reactors that we currently build on Earth, the usually fission reactors, are absolutely huge, although the core is very small. And in a submarine, it's a small stripped-down version of that, but they are still very large. You pack the rods in there, and the rods, as they undergo radioactive decay, produce heat, which you then extract into either a gas or water, and you use that to produce usually steam that you then use in a turbine system to drive propulsion or generators to then drive motors and so on. Now, that is great for on the Earth or in a submarine or in a massive great boat. But getting things into space is risky. It's dangerous. Just take a look at the news in recent years. We've seen quite a few things blow up on the launch pad. And so as a result, people are uncomfortable putting what could amount to extremely high level radioactive waste into a rocket, which could explode and then fill the atmosphere with nuclear waste. So if we have alternatives that are safer and cleaner, like solar panels, which we've got no shortage of sunlight in Earth orbit, then we use that. If we're going farther afield, though, we can use nuclear energy. And there was a news report last week about the Voyagers on the Naked Scientist, the Voyager probes, now 46 years old and about 24 billion kilometres from the Earth. They're still going in their 47th year, and they're powered by nuclear power. How are they doing it? They're doing it from a very intensely radioactive source, which as it decays produces a lot of heat, and that drives a thermoelectric generator, which is a device that uses a heat difference to produce a potential electrical difference. So it's not totally wrong to say we shouldn't have and we don't have nuclear power in space. We do, but we don't use fission reactors, which are big, bulky, heavy, and if the rocket blew up, would be a massive source of contamination because of the amount of fuel that they would have to have in them. We don't use that for space at the moment for that reason.
And then I guess Gwen is not very happy with the sales pitch. Her question, can mattresses and pillows help reduce snoring?
Well, what snoring is probably at the root of this question, isn't it? And when we are asleep at night, we are breathing, of course. We have to breathe. That's obligatory to keep us alive and keep oxygen going in and carbon dioxide going out. But it has to go down your windpipe. And at the back of your throat are soft tissues, which when we're awake are stabilized by muscle tone. In the same way that when you stand up, you don't have to think about contracting muscles in the back of your leg. You have postural muscles that provide tone to keep joints stable and keep you upright. But when you go to sleep, everything relaxes. You shut down lots of these muscles, and as a result, your airways become floppier. As we get older, that floppiness gets worse. And also with weight gain and possibly with bad posture, you end up with more floppy airways, and the soft tissues at the back of the throat can flap down and partially occlude the intake that the air is being drawn into, and it pulls, because of the low pressure as you breathe in, it pulls the soft tissue down against the inlet, causing it to make a rasping sound because it vibrates in the passing air and partially blocks. So how can you stop that happening? Well, one of the ways to stop it is better posture. So sleeping in certain positions, so you're not laying on your back with your head flopped back, reducing the chances of the posture enabling the tissue to fall backwards. So some things that stabilize a certain posture can help. But the best way to do this is to try to maintain the tone of those muscles. Don't end up with extra flab around your neck. So if you are a bit weighty, try and keep the weight down, because that will help keep things from pressing in on the airways and reduce the risk of snoring in the first place. But some pillows and that kind of thing might help a bit. But you have to find out. You have to try and find out if that's going to help you, because everyone's different. Everyone's different shape, different size, different reason why they might be snoring.
And that's where we're going to have to rest it for today. A big thank you, Dr. Chris Smith. A lecture at Cambridge University, of course, The Naked Scientist, to us every Friday just after 9:30, and an opportunity for you to ask those questions that keep you awake at night. Hopefully some peaceful sleep is due to some of the people who posted questions this morning. News coming your way at the top of the hour.